Hiya, welcome to Darren One Podcast. I am your host, Akakande Mukandepwe, also known as Aka. If you know me, you know that one of the things I enjoy to do is a date at the museum, shopping, and probably meeting strangers. I thrive at it so much. I don't think people know that I love strangers more than I love the people I know. Like, I enjoy walking up to somebody and telling them they look pretty, or just asking which country they're from. And last year in October, I had the pleasure of meeting this beautiful lady in Mr. Price. And I was like, hey, how are you? I'm fine. Oh, you look pretty. And we had this whole conversation. My friends were like, yeah, that's something you would do. But then we had a book date, a museum date. Can you imagine meeting somebody and you go on different dates the next day or days later, and they get to travel out of the country and back to the country, and you still get to be friends? So today's guest is that person. She is amazing, and I'm truly grateful that I got to meet her, and I'm truly grateful we get to do this episode. We have been missing each other for a while, and today seems like the right day to put this one in the books. With that being said, welcome my friend Nuria. Hi, Nuria.
Hi, Aka. It's such a pleasure to have this conversation.
Finally.
finally, in capital letters, finally.
With exclamation marks, finally.
Yeah. But that was such a good introduction as well. It was. I swear, I always look back to the day we met and to the pictures, and I'm like, wow, like, I just met someone at a store, and then we got to hang out and then, like, build a whole friendship afterwards. That was amazing.
I also think it's one thing I really enjoy, and I have met a couple of people like that. And then I have conversations with other people, and I meet them at events. And we're like, girl. I think it's the one best way to meet strangers. For me, it's not as...
Yeah.
For me, it's out living life in my day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And I'm randomly just like, hey, you're good. I'm good. So, yeah, I look back to how we just said talking to each other. And ended up...
I should get a few tips from you, because I'm very anxious. I'm a very anxious person. So sometimes going to, like, a new place and then going up to someone and, like, forming a friendship with them, for me, it's a bit hard. And so when you approach me that day, it's like, oh, this, she's so sweet. And then I'm like, this is so cute. I've never experienced it, but this is so cute.
Trust me. I am introverted, but it's happened a lot of times. And for me, maybe it's how you look. I always find something, I'm like, you look so pretty. I like your necklace. It's all those things where I'm like, oh my goodness, I want to have that. Let me ask where I got it. Sometimes there are just so many pretty ladies out there. Could we just compliment them? Like, hey.
Yeah. They compliment each other.
Yeah, a lot of things would solve a lot of problems. So if I would meet you in Kenya. Okay, Nuria is from Kenya, by the way.
Yeah.
If I would meet you in Nairobi, how best would you introduce yourself?
Oh, wow. This is so funny, because I just started a course yesterday about storytelling. And it was very interesting, because they shared a bit of, like, an app where you introduce yourself and you have to be creative about it. And I like calling myself a creative, but then I also feel like, you know, like, creatives, I think we also sometimes are shy to call ourselves creatives, because we feel like we have to get to some level.
Yeah.
But I think now I'm very set on, if I ever meet someone, I'd always introduce myself like, hi, my name is Nuria and I'm a creative plant lover. That's it for me.
I like that. I think that I have the same sentiments. I don't think I'm a creative. I'm very skeptical about calling myself a creative.
Yeah.
Because I sometimes don't think I want the weight that comes with. So
what exactly
does that mean when I call myself a creative? How will people look at me if I deviate from that? I like it to introduce myself as a business person, because in anything happens, I feel like a business person can be creative, I guess, and
that's true, yeah.
Creative with how they run their business and everything they do. So yeah, like I like that you said that. It's something I have been battling with. I'm like, okay, I do not know if I should introduce myself as a creative, but I'm glad that you have made peace with the fact that you're creative, which you are, by the way. So now we are teachers.
Yeah. Plus, you know, I think also when we look at it, I think people also look at creativity as someone who, you know, is you either like, you know, in the artistic space, yeah. You're either doing photography, illustrations, painting, you're an artist, a singer, but you could be all of that. But then it's also, I think, in how you also handle your life. There are people who are very creative in literally everything they do. And I feel like when I started living alone, I started seeing that I actually do have, aside from being a photographer and sort of like an illustrator, I do also include a lot of creativity in the way I cook, in the things, in how I arrange my house, in how I arrange my desk. And I think that's why I made peace with it. Like, actually, I am a creative. So like we should all embrace it. If you have like the slightest bit of creativity in you, whether you're not, you know, in the mainstream creativity ecosystem, you can still call yourself a creative.
What I like about this is that we're talking about, and you're mentioning and highlighting redefining what creativity means, because mm-hmm. sometimes when we think of creativity, like you mentioned, I think of artists, painters, and I am not that. You know what I mean? Like I'm not a really good blogger and everything. So when we mm-hmm. think of creative and the creative ecosystem, if I would identify one thing, I wouldn't identify as so many. So it's also really good that you are mentioning, and we're talking about how creativity could just come from how you're cooking, how you dress up,
yeah.
How you set up your house, how you do stuff. They could be
creative. How you do stuff. That.
So mm-hmm. I love that a lot.
Yeah. It's a good one, basically.
How did you get into photography?
Okay, so this, I think I get a lot of questions sometimes when people see me doing photography. One, I think being a female, and number two, being a Muslim female.
Yeah.
I do get a lot of questions of how did you get into photography? And I don't know, my honest answer is I'm not sure. I think maybe one day I just saw, okay, to build a context, I've grown in a family where my father took pictures of literally everything. I think we even have pictures of ourselves, probably like taking the visiting the toilet for the first time. I think we all, we're four kids, and I think everyone. My dad has a picture of everyone doing like their fast. And but I think growing up, it was so cringe because then the visitors would come and the album would be like, woof, opened up, and you'd see yourself with just a vest on and probably a diaper or no diaper. And I'm like, oh my God. But then, I think as I grew up, especially I think campus is when you sort of like redefine yourself and start knowing yourself. And a lot of the times, I think I had the privilege of going to campus and, you know, staying at home because campus was very close. We're in the same town, actually. And so a lot of my weekends, I'm not a very social person, as I began this whole conversation with, but a lot of my weekends, I try to make the most from my weekends. So sometimes I would start rearranging sort of like the library, and then I'd end up looking into you know, the pictures. And this was like in my first year in university. And so I don't know, for some reason, I thought I found it so amazing to sort of like, you know, have a different eye when it comes to taking pictures. And so just starting with taking pictures with my phone, I think that was the time when selfies was a really big thing.
Yeah.
But for me, selfies were never really, I felt like they were just very plain. And I wanted a bit of context in my pictures. So sometimes I would shoot through like a plant, I would shoot through stuff, and that was just using my phone. And so as any other teenager during that time, I ran to YouTube to start looking at, you know, phone photography. And then I remember telling my dad, you know what? I need a camera. And he was like, You know, if you, you know, for I think for African parents, I think at that time, their biggest priority when you're in university is you get a laptop, you do your homework, you do your assignments. That's it for me. I pay your school fees, we're done. And so he gave me the two options. You either get a camera or a laptop. And I was like, Dad, you need them both because I need to edit on the laptop. And then he's like, what I can do now is get you a camera. So I need to see your commitment if you really do need a camera or you need a laptop for your studies.
Yeah.
And so I ended up with a camera and I used to take pictures, just random pictures in schools. I used to just look for, you know, sort of like friends and just have them do a photo shoot and take pictures for free and just go to a cyber at the end of the day and just edit them and then share them on my Instagram. And I think that's how it began. So I think that's how me getting into photography started. I think it was just an influence from my dad specifically. He's always had something to do with digital camera, with the old school cameras, and he always used to videotape everything that we do. And I think that sort of like rubbed off on me. So I would say probably from my dad.
I love that you negotiated your way. And if I was asked that at that time when I'm starting university, I'd probably say I need a laptop. And I love that you still chose to pick your pick and say, okay, great, I will get to choose a camera and navigate school without a laptop.
Mm-hmm. So yeah.
It's not what we hear. And for context sake, not everybody can get what they want at that particular mm-hmm. time, especially majority of African households. We know that our parents always have to make us pick something. So it's like, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
By the way, I love taking pictures as well. I think that I'm in process of getting a camera. I'm so obsessed right now.
And I think your pictures are really so great. Like, if I have never mentioned that, you have a really good aesthetic, especially for Instagram. Your pictures are dope. Very nice.
I try. None of my friends like taking pictures of me because they say I'm particular. Everywhere in the world, they're like, you're so particular on how
in the pictures.
Yeah. And I'm like, but I do have a decent phone. I don't think with my decent phone it's okay for you to take an ugly picture. And it becomes a back and forth. I love my friends, by the way. I love you guys so much and appreciate you tolerating me. I think I'm getting back to like the white and black pictures, and I want the instant cameras where you take a picture and it like a physical copy comes out. I don't know how they call it.
Yeah.
I want to go back to owning. Yes. I want to go back to owning a photo album because I just realized that I travel a lot. I do a lot of stuff. I take a lot of pictures. And unfortunately, even on my phone, it's rare for me to go back and check my pictures. But every time I go back to my baby albums, I'm like, oh, I did this.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because I think it's so funny, because I feel like as much as a lot of us, maybe millennials who grew up, you know, with that African household and things, you know, we had like a bit of both the sort of like non-digital analog world, call it analog, the analog world, and then the digital world. I think for us who had a bit of both, a lot of us are sort of like trying to go back to like the old analog sort of like lifestyle, like have, you know, like have a bit of touch with it. Because exactly what you're saying is the same thing I think I was thinking about a few days ago. And I'm like, I have so many pictures, especially sometimes when I go to weddings and these events, like forget the couple shots, but there are some really nice pictures I take that I would actually sell this picture or like frame it up and put it in my house. Like, why do I have to buy a painting or like, you know, someone else's creativity when I can do that for myself, or like just have a bunch of pictures on my fridge? I'm like, so I think we are slowly, I think it's an amazing thing to see. Even the fact that I think on Instagram, I saw a lady who sort of like has, you know, the old telephones that ring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she sort of like had a way where she connected her smartphone to that analog phone. And I think for me, it's amazing to see we're trying to go back to our roots and sort of like, damn you, AI, at the end of it all.
I think that for me, it's everything is so digital, right?
Yeah.
I understand why you and I connect digitally on Instagram or WhatsApp. It's because you and I are not in the same country.
Yeah.
But I feel like you and I had a great time at the museum. We had a great time at a bookstore. Mm-hmm. I want to document that somewhere and not on my phone, because I do everything on my phone. I work on my phone. I connect with people on my phone, that I want something physical. And maybe because that's my love language. I'm just thinking, I grew up in a house, like you said, going back to analog and going back to that sense, is my grandfather liked documenting stuff. And we have pictures back home of all of us in the living room and everything. I think that's me. I think that I see that for myself, and I'm like, yes, anything to get me off the internet, anything to get me off my phone is what I am actively searching for right now. So I like that. And also, I also love to live in a wood, in the woods somewhere. So it says a lot about
me. Oh my God. We should get married, because I feel like for me, I did a tweet a few days ago. I'm like, the goal is to get a farmhouse, an art studio, and just a garden somewhere in the woods. And my only job would be, you know, come to the market once a week, share my produce with everyone, and just go back in solitary. I'm like, that would be, I don't know.
For me, my goal is to have all that, but have a chopper to drop me off work and bring me back home. That's the goal.
Like, wow.
That's how rich I plan to be. And if I'm ever married and my husband feels like, oh no, I love to live in a city, that's his own business. Like, personally,
that's your own thing.
Personally, I genuinely want to be fun. So I'll have my pilot drop me off at work and take me back home. And if we have down their own, honestly, at this point, I just love being alone. And just having your own space, being with nature, I think we take it so much for granted. But
that's true.
And also farm and everything. But I don't think I love to farm as much. But I'll probably have a mini garden. But yeah. But living with other animals, I feel like animals are better company than human beings.
I think it's because human beings, I think we're just in each other's business too much.
Yes,
all need to like calm down.
It's like I have to care so much about what other people think about me. Even if I say I don't care, deep down.
Yeah. Deep down you do care, because it's people you interact with. Like, I think it's something we grew up being told, like, you need, like, don't care what people say. But it's so hard. Like, in reality, it's really hard, because you, like, we're not an island in the jobs we go to, the schools we go to, the places we hang out. It's very, you're never alone. You're always like sharing energy with people. And so a lot of the time it's very hard to just be like, you know, I'll just do what I want. I wouldn't care what people think. Because sometimes that can also come off the wrong way for other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just a balance, I think.
Yeah, it's that balance. And like you said, we want, what default to want to be liked. Like, I want to be liked. I want.
Yeah.
People to like me. And so that's our default setting, because you're a human being, you're a social being, you want to be accepted by others. Even I know my default is I want to people please, but I also want to like set boundaries. And I'm like, am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? Is it rubbing off people the wrong way? It's just questions that always be back and forth, which is a good one anyway. But yeah, so it's something really that you and I can really just reminisce about, how to live on a farm with no people. Oh, I was actually going to say that I lived at my grandmother's, my home, the house I grew up in January. I think I was from like April to mid-May or month-end May. It was like a six-week period or more than that, where I was just having so much fun. So my grandmother there is very big, so no one is in your space like that, and we have a lot of animals. Do you people just don't understand how much I enjoyed interacting with just animals? Like, of course, we had help and everything. But it gave me a sense of I could really live off, if I have the money now, I could really live off the grid and be happy. And come
honestly, yeah.
People a few times in a year. And to be honest, now that's going to be me. Like, I'll just be Oprah. She just talks about her books and everything else she does. I will be Oprah and I'll be happy.
But I think, honestly, 100%, I think that's the vibe to go with. Like, there's just too much happening and cities are getting crowded. Everyone just needs to just sort of like look for a farm somewhere and just like settle down.
Yeah, true. So one thing I love about you is we talk about literacy in general, right? Literacy in terms of reading and writing. Realizing that there's different types of literacy. I like to talk about the financial literacy part because I feel like a lot of us are not financially literate and our school system doesn't really support us in that way. And one thing I realize is for you, it's climate literacy. And that's so exciting. I didn't know that one existed. I really want to kind of learn how you stumbled upon working in the climate change sector and just talking about literacy and education.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, perfectly as you put it, I think we sort of like match in the fact that we both saw a gap that existed that was not addressed properly during our time. And I think it got worse as we grew up and with the generations who are currently going to school. So for me, climate literacy wasn't something that was always on my mind, to be completely honest. Again, I think after university, still finding yourself, trying to get your roots and what you're really interested in, I spent some time with my parents in their shamba, in their garden. And we would do, we didn't do, like commercial farming or like some serious kind of farming, just the farming where I feel like for my parents, it was just to give them a bit of change in their routine. And also, you can't keep the land idle. I think that's also like a very common phrase that's in Kenya. You can't leave the land idle. You either construct something, you either plant something, keep it, like make use of it. So at that time, I think it was after uni, I spent, almost six to 10 months with them every single day. We'd go Monday to Saturday, we're going to the farm. And so I think it came to a point where we didn't have good water. That is the rainfall. The rainfall wasn't very, it wasn't as guaranteed as we used to have it back then. And so my dad had the idea of drilling a borehole. Where the shamba is, for context, is a bit of a dry land. And so it's a semi-arid area. So definitely water for you to manage your vegetation, you have to have like good access to water. And so he drilled a borehole. And one of the quality or one of the unique aspects of that semi-arid area is people used to buy water. And so when dad drilled this borehole, we had a few members of the community would come to buy water. And a lot of the times it used to be children. So children would be sent by their parents with gallons of, the how do we call them, jerry cans, mtungis, with the jerry cans, 20 liters, 10 liters to come and buy water. And so I would see how excited they would get when they come to our farm and they would see a mango tree, they would see a guava tree, they would see a passion fruit little plant that's crawling on a tree. And they would be scared to like go and pluck a fruit because then this is someone's garden. But I think my dad was quite easy. She was like, if there are fruits, it's okay, you can come in, like climb the tree, pluck them, just make sure you're not wasting. And so a lot of the times when they leave school, the first thing they come to the garden, even if you've not been sent by your mom to buy water, you just force yourself with a jerry can to come and buy water to get a chance to get some fruits. And so I think I got to spend a lot of time with them just playing around with water and stuff like that. And in my mind, I remember the peace and tranquility that came with farming and just having that rural setup where it's just you and nature. And then I really appreciated the produce. I think sometimes we talk about, the earth being a giver and Mother Nature being a giver, but we never really, I think, sort of like sit down and internalize what does that actually mean, because it's such a miracle to put a seed in the earth and then rain and then you get a whole plant out of it. I think we really underestimate that, and that's why with what is happening in Kenya right now, so many people are buying urbanization. It's at a very high rate in areas like, for example, where my hometown is, vegetation and farming is a really key aspect to people's, you know, livelihoods. And so now that's sort of like diminishing to the point where my hometown is called Meru County, which is one of the breadbaskets of Kenya, is currently, you know, declining in that scale of breadbasket counties within Kenya. And a lot of women and children are definitely the number one people who are affected by it. And so I think I got to sit down and sort of like think, where does the problem actually start? And the thing is, it definitely starts from school, because if I was to look back at how my education was, I remember having a lot of classes that were done outside. We're just like, you know, the children would just be like, you know, today is a science class, we are going outside. I remember picking up grasshoppers and, you know, looking at them when you're talking about the legs and how they're in the structure of their body. I remember picking up birds. I remember, you know, collecting different types of leaves and sticking them to our books to show, like, this is a compound leaf, this is a simple leaf. It was so interesting to realize that education has really changed, and kids don't get that attachment to nature as we did back then. And I think that's also why for someone like me or someone who's my age, littering is a big deal. Like, I would catch me dead throwing like a paper on the ground or somewhere where there's not like a designated dustbin. I'd rather carry it back home. But then for now, you can see kids just throwing paper in dirt like it's nothing. And then you can't really, when you look at it, you can't really blame the child, but you definitely have to blame the upbringing. And it all starts from school, because even for kids, they spend much of their lifetime in school as opposed to being at home. And so my sister and I got to thinking, and we're like, we need to, like, and for her, it was personal because she has kids in a city. And these kids in a city, first of all, they're in a school that doesn't even have a playground. And to look at the provisions of the law when it comes to building a school, you have to provide a playground for kids to play around. It has to be a serene environment for the kids. And so I think looking at it, and then you get to see the dangers of it, you get to see even your kids are not able to even identify different types of, you know, they can't really even tell this is a butterfly, this is a moth. They only know these cockroach insects in the house and mosquitoes. And that was such a letdown, because then what sort of generation are we really bringing up? And now you see when the people start talking about climate, they don't really address it in a way that, okay, you're talking about climate at a very high table level, where you're talking about carbon credits, you're talking about climate justice, you're talking about, you know, very technical words that are not really trickled down to what the community itself can do. So we felt like there was that mismatch, and instead of like, and we also understood that for us to get a behavior change, because with climate, it's literally a behavior change. For us to really bring a behavior change in our community, the best people to work with are kids. They're very open-minded, they're very fun to engage with, they're very, you know, creative people who just need a bit of resources and a bit of training. And they have a lot of time on their hands. And so I think that's where my organization started, Rototo Go Green. And instead of, we looked at it in the way where instead of, you know, taking kids to plant trees, which we would later on down in the line come and look at the trees and we can see nothing has really grown.
Yeah.
We'd rather instill the climate literacy, instill a bit of fun. So we usually call it play, learn and thrive. You learn at the same time, you get to be very playful, and then you thrive, and then your community thrives as well. And so that's where I think the organization started. And we, in our sort of like our mission was climate literacy for a greener climate.
I like that. I like how you have broken it down, given the history, given the context, and given us where you are right now. I was actually had a guest, Clydon. Yeah, I had a guest, and we talked about climate change and water. So we were just focusing on water. Or what does it mean when there's a drought? What does it mean when there's a flood? And I loved how he broke it down so well, because When we talk about climate change, it's so big and broad. When we talk about SDGs, they feel so big that people that are in these spaces are not breaking it down for us, for a layman person to understand. Like, if I do not have access to this information, how do I understand that this is important? How do I implement it? How do I even notice it's affecting me? How is it affecting me in different ways? And why are certain things happening now and not? So I love that that's the stance your organization has taken. And I was going to ask, what does play, learn, and thrive mean? Because I saw that when I was doing more research on you, and I was like, oh, this is such a good catchphrase. I wonder in what context it is in. Yeah.
So play, learn, thrive is sort of like our building block when it comes to Otogo Green. So we have three primary blocks, which are educate, there's innovate, and then there's also the advocacy. And so with Play, Learn, Thrive is to try to, you know, in every single building block that we are implementing, which is sort of like our building block is our program, we try to ensure kids are playful, kids are able to learn, and kids are able to, like, you know, innovate and thrive within it. And so it's very interesting because I think initially, as you know, when you start something out, there's always the growth, you know, the growth curve that you go through.
Yeah.
And in the initial stages of our growth curve was really piloting a lot of ideas, so many ideas that we all had in mind. And that's why we started with the idea, okay, should we just go and plant trees? And then we start telling them about trees. But then when you look at climate, it's not just about planting trees. And I think that's why even sometimes these initiatives that are brought in by government about, you know, we're going to plant 1 million trees, you're going to plant 1 billion trees. It's not just about trees. There's just so much that happens for that tree to grow that people don't have the knowledge about. You need to check your soils, you need to check your water, you need to have like a decent environment that's not polluted. And so we channel this into a way, like, how can we break this down in very simple, playful language that kids can understand? And so Play, Learn, Thrive again comes through how we approach learning. And so for us, learning is mostly through creative art. And like, for example, the pilot school that we're currently working with in Meru County, we have programs where we educate them about, you know, climate in general. And so we approach it in a way where we do skits, we do theaters, we do photography, we do a bit of plastic renovation or upcycling. And then we also do a lot of movie screenings and documentary screenings. And so the idea is, it's a very big concept. It's very scary. There's also like climate anxiety that comes with all these technical terms. But to you, as you know, as a young 13-year-old, 12-year-old, what does your environment, like, how does your environment affect you in how you live? What kind of environments do you live in? And so even a lot of the times when we approach kids and tell them what an environment is, and then we tell them, describe your environment at home, they get to hear how it's actually very different, because they would have someone who, you know, would say, I live in a very rural setup. We have a cow, we have a goat, we have a chicken, we have a small garden. And then you'd hear someone who lives in a town. We don't have a playground, we just have a parking lot, we're in the fifth apartment, you know. And so it opens up their mind to actually see that my space might be very different from someone else's space, but then we are all like, we sort of like affect each other in a way. And so bringing it to their kids' understandings, and then including games and stuff like that, has been very interesting to us, because then we start to see them taking small steps within their own schools and classes to sort of like just make the environment a bit better. And I think the one thing within, again, our growth curve that we've learned is kids really want to be engaged. They don't want these lectures where we, you know, like, for us, it's fine. We can sit we can go for a 3-day training and you're in a conference day 1 to day 5.
Yeah.
But you can't take the same approach with children. Like, children need, they're very, I think I usually tell them, your hands are very itchy, because they want to touch, they want to help, they want to see, they'll ask you 1 million questions, and they always want to do it by themselves. And so we always try to ensure that the projects we have are very hands-on. And so we had a pilot garden at one of the schools. And I think this is the beauty of public schools, which is why I think private institutions need to borrow a lot from public schools. Because yeah. When you look at public schools, you always say they're resource deficit. We always say, they don't have enough books. They're not paying enough fees. The teachers are demoralized, which a lot of them are true because there are so many factors affecting public schools. But then if you look at the structure of a public school, it's actually very, very, if it was followed to the latter, it's a very unique system that really works. Because public schools, first of all, in their curriculum, they have to have extracurricular activities. Within their curriculum, they have to have 1 hour lunch breaks for kids. Yeah. Because they understand that the mentality or the brain of a child needs to develop through play. And I think that's something very important that we try to incorporate in the learnings we have. So by setting up a small garden in one of the public schools, we've given kids, number one, a responsibility, because you have a sort of like a timetable. So we set up a club, and everyone in that club is, given a responsibility every week or every day of the week. Your responsibility is to look at the water. Have the plants been watered? And another group's for responsibility will be look at the health of your plant. Does it have yellow leaves? Are the roots looking rotted? And so for them, they might see it as something very, like I'm just looking at it and then I leave. But then when we come again and look for results, we get to hear how they themselves even came up with strategies. So yeah. They're like, oh, I saw that the leaves were rotting. And so we decided not to water it every single week. Oh, I saw that their weeds were coming up, so we decided to, reduce on the water and sort of like work on removing the weeds. And I think especially for that school, it has been a really great initiative for the kids. We've seen progress in how they now look at science as a subject, because now it's more hands-on. And a lot of the things they learn, they're able to go back and try on their pilot gardens. So I think the idea of play, learn, thrive is really just to satisfy their itchy hands and their curiosity, because children need to play and have fun.
I like that. I think I've been having a lot of conversation is amongst parents, because mostly I was my younger sister's guardian. I'm always like, kids have so much energy, and having them to be in class from 8 to 3 p.m. is not a good idea. Having class start at 8 is a chore. Just because I am formally learning less in terms of a class, for context sake, doesn't mean I'm not learning. Actually, kids learn a lot through play. And if our curriculums was very hands-on, they have a lot of energy, and they spend so much time, it's very hard to kind of just have them sit there and go like, yeah, sit here, figure it out kind of thing. Doesn't work out. So I like that. I like that. I don't even know what I can say about it, but I really enjoy that. And also I like that when you were setting up your organization and throwing out a lot of pilot projects, you just didn't think of the traditional way of how climate change has been handled over the years. Let's all plant trees, right? I was part of a climate change club. I was an ambassador. And one thing we did emphasize on was planting trees, plant trees, plant trees, that type of thing. And it didn't work so well, right? Because, again, climate change is very broad. It's a lot going on. Planting trees is not the only thing you can do to mitigate climate change. Like, it's not the only solution there. But it seems like, I think it's the easiest one, or one that is easy to track.
Yeah, it's the easiest one, yeah.
And I think it's also easy to track, is why a lot of organizations and government like to pursue that one. But I love that you are exploring different facts, and you're exploring and teaching the children responsibility, which is something we should start doing pretty early to find and integrate it into their system. So I really love the breakdown.
Yeah, because I think at the end of it all, really, is as you put it, I think there's the fact that there are so many elements that come when we talk about climate change. When we start, I think when we start with children with something as small as taking care of a bean plant or like a maize plant, then we can start talking about trees and why trees are beneficial. No. And you'll see themselves because we also include a lot of fruit trees when you're planting, when you're setting up the gardens, and you could see, you could, as the adults, you could be the ones who are going to water the trees and doing, you know, all of that, because we wanted to like leave the garden responsibility to the children. But then you slowly see them going to the trees, because now it's not a very big scary concept to grow this huge tree. Because if I was able to plant a cabbage, plant, you know, a chili tree, I'm able to like take care of a whole tree. So I think that's where, as you've said, we've sort of like tried to take the easy way out. And so like have people plant a billion trees, and then at the end of it all, we say we've planted a million trees. But then going back to, has this tree actually impacted the community? Is, I think, where now we get a bit of a mismatch. So yeah, I think yeah, I totally agree with you.
And I totally love the concept, and I am now looking forward to just seeing how everybody else is doing it and how we are incorporating fun. Okay, I just like having fun, guys. I think that I always say to myself, if I would die today, I believe everybody in my life would know I had fun. Like I enjoyed every aspect, the good and the bad. There's so much you can always learn for it. And that's why I really like your concept, because it really just breaks down everything. And one thing we should all realize is that a lot of people learn differently. So for other people, what might seem as a big complex planting trees, other kids find that very easy. But majority of the kids are just like, oh my goodness, I don't even understand what you're talking about.
That's true.
So one thing I've also noticed is, talks about sustainable financing. I'm wondering what that is. For me, it's like, what do you mean by sustainable financing? I know what sustainability is. I think I know what sustainability is. Again, it goes back to how we use words and what context it's in, but then we're using so many words now. I'll say we're using so many big words now, and I don't think majority of us understand what they mean. Does that make sense? Yeah. And majority of us, I mean, me too, like, what does it mean by sustainable living, sustainable finance? And why I'm bringing this to you, I think you're an expert in this, and I'm really kind of like, yeah, so when you think about your work and what you're doing, how does sustainable financing play a role?
So with I think I'll talk about this from the point of being a founder of a young organization, and then I'll also talk about it with my current role with where I work. And so looking at a young founder, I think one of the challenges we all face is getting donor funding and getting support and resources to sort of like push your initiatives. And the sad bit of it is we have the donor ecosystem and how it looks at organizations, especially in the Global South and Africa as a whole, is we give you the money, you do the projects, and then after the grant period is done, we're back to you asking for more money. And especially when the whole Trump situation happened with USAID and a lot of funding was sort of like cut down, I think that's where sustainability really sort of like stood out. And for me, it was such a sad situation to see big organizations closing down like a week after the Trump announcement. And it made me ask myself, when I approach these big organizations for money and for support, the one question they ask me is, how sustainable will you be during the grant period and after the grant period? And for me, this was always a very tricky question, because for me, and when you go to a donor and get the money from the donor, it always comes with a lot of, you know, requirements. And sometimes you get to see you're implementing a program that wasn't really your core mandate, but because it has a bit of money attached to it, you need to like continue growing and scaling as an organization. So sustainable finance for me is looking at the money and the support that we are getting, the funds and the support we're getting from donor organizations, philanthropies, and any crowdfunding initiatives we have. How are we able to continue the work, whether the organizations are there or not? And so for Toto Go Green, it was a bit tricky, because with young organizations, you get to realize the founders are the program managers, they're the accountants, they're their human resource. You're literally playing like 1,000 roles at once. And for me, I have a really good team of volunteers, but then having to engage so many people for a project and not being able to sustain them, in terms of a payroll, was a bit of sort of like a strain for me. And so I had to look at my organization and see, okay, we are applying for support and funding. How am I able to make Watch Go Green sort of like reinvest in itself and sort of like invest in things that will bring back the money to the organization so that we can continue the work, whether we have donor funding or we don't have donor funding. So I think in a nutshell, it's just looking at your organizations and looking and sort of like analyzing the programs you have vis-a-vis sort of like the expenses and the administration costs you have, and seeing how am I able to sustain my community work or my organization's work without having complete dependency on external funding and external support.
I like the breakdown a lot, because what that also does is that it gives me a glimpse of what actually happens in the NGO world. And one thing, because I have volunteered a lot, I know that donor funding also works like a trend. There are certain things that will be funded at certain times. For example, maybe now what is being more funded are mental health issues, because that's the cry most people are having. It's, oh no, we have mental health issues, we want them funded. So then donors might be funding a lot of organizations that are specialized in this part of work. So I'm glad that when you're thinking of how sustainable, how can you continue doing what you're doing without donor funding? I think a lot of nonprofit organizations don't think about it that way. Maybe in the past. Now, I feel like a lot has changed and more people are aware, but probably in the past, a lot didn't think so. So, yeah, I really loved the breakdown.
And, you know, I think the other side of it is, I think when you look, especially now with the role that I have in the current organization that I'm in, I sort of like have a lot of engagements with young CSOs and young organizations within Africa. And a lot of the times when we reach out to them and ask them, like, okay, so what we do is really we try to empower our communities through legal empowerment, and that is how to know the law, how to use the law that's provided for your, you know, to acquire justice, and how to, you know, like sort of like shape the law and do strategies that it works for your community and for the injustice you're advocating for. And so a lot of these communities or the CSOs, when we have conversations with them in terms of like, okay, so what, we've given you the legal empowerment knowledge, we've taught you how to sort of like build grassroots leadership, what other support would you require? There's always, we need resources. And you know, I think resources are sort of like at this point, a bit scarce. There's so many organizations looking for so much money every single day. And the work needs to continue, because communities are facing injustice. There's a lot of, you know, advocacy work on so many issues that needs to continue to happen. But I think we need to have discussions about how do you as an organization grow? How do you mobilize resources from your community and have, you know, your own philanthropy sort of like work going on, instead of like always going for the same organizations to get money. And as you've put it, the themes are always changing. Therefore, if I'm to speak from a climate point of view, for me, it's climate literacy, climate and climate justice. And there's also like climate education through creative art. But then sometimes you get to see a shift in donor funding, and you'd see like it's now climate tech, because now tech has become a very big thing. There's also climate and the effects it has on women. There's also funding for that angle. So for a young organization, since you want to grow, you get to find yourself, you're always shifting gear to, you know, fit donor requirements. And then at the end of it all, when you look back at the books to look at where you were and where you are now, you might have grown in terms of scale and impact, but then you get to see you've sort of like abandoned the initial priorities you had because you're always pegged on donor funding and donor requirements.
Yeah.
So I think also maybe the other question that needs to be addressed is, could there be a discussion on how the donor ecosystem actually is, especially for African countries?
Because I swear.
Because our context is so different and how our culture is so different and how we approach community work, I feel like is very different. And it's usually very sad to see. I think personally, as someone who has been applying for so many grants, it's very sad to see a donor giving you so many requirements on how to do your work and then limiting the money to certain projects, limiting the money to certain items. And mm-hmm. you look at it, you're like, this is not our mission or our vision as a young organization. But because we need the money, we have to adjust, because at the end of it, we have to do a donor report. But yeah. I think that as much as we keep saying inclusivity in this roundtables, inclusivity in these discussions, there needs to be a discussion on how can we adjust how can donors adjust their requirements and their money to be very African friendly and to fit an African context. Because I think also so many CSOs want to understand the mind of a donor. What does the donor actually think?
Yeah.
So that for me, I can see how to either work around that or propose sort of like strategies and initiatives for the donor to also sort of like look at.
I like that. I like that question a lot because, like you said, there's always a shift. And I share opportunities to young people on our WhatsApp community. I see the shift. Like, I can even notice, like, oh my goodness, there's a shift in what programs are being invested in now.
Exactly.
Like, there's always a shift every 3 months. And I'm like, what happened in the space of 3 months that there's such a big shift?
Yeah.
And again, like, what's happening with the big donors that this shift is happening? And sometimes I feel like it's not even about most programs that are for African communities or countries are not even influenced by Africans. I don't even know if how many Africans are part of the table when conversations are had about the shift they are about to make, because this is all about money. For context sake, like, nothing can happen without money, and the people that are giving us money are restricting us to certain things. The bigger question would be, why are we being restricted to those things? So I hear you. And when you were talking about donor funding and the shift that happens in that ecosystem, I want to look for a donor and just have that conversation and have a perspective to say, okay, so what really goes on when decisions are made? Because I think, surprisingly, holistically, the shift happens at once.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm wrong, but it happens at once. Now the new shift is AI. I think there's a shift in AI. Yeah, there's like a lot of AI stuff going on. Hi. Hey, Nuria.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. So I know now there's like a shift. Like you said, there's a lot about technology, how it impacts women. I know a lot will be happening about AI now, how it's going to impact us, the environment and everything. Just a shift has happened. So maybe also it has to do with global trends. I know AI is like a really big global trend. Mental health is really becoming a global trend that openly everybody is talking about it. That in 5 years, certain things that were being funded will stop being funded because the shift in the ecosystem is trying to put in money in certain projects. And I also think now also the real question is it sustainable that we're always having a jump in what should be funded?
Is it really worth always having a jump? And then I think also, is it sustainable to always be having a jump? Because the question is, if the priority area for this year was climate and health, and then 3 years down the line that has changed, does that mean the issue of climate and health is done? And does that mean we don't have any other, we don't have, those issues on the ground? And the fact that I think there's so many, I think even now there's so many young organizations coming up. I think there's a whole also like a different world order that's coming up, and people are demanding for justice, demanding for accountability. And so you can see so many young organizations sort of like rising to talk about so many issues that when you look at what is being funded, you don't see these issues there. But if you were to look at the issues being funded 5 years ago, 6 years ago, you'd find them there. So the question really is, has there been, you know, expertise to do research to see we've made this shift on the basis of ABCD? Because like in Kenya now, health is actually, I think, at its worst at this point. And the fact that USAID pulled out is even a way worse sort of like reality for us now. And I think at that point when that happened is when even for Kenyans, we got to realize apparently so many programs within our public hospitals were being run on donor funding. And so the government was just sitting, scot-free, just eating up the money that we pay in terms of taxes for health, because it was sort of like a drastic drop in terms of the quality of services, the programs being offered. And so the question really is, once we look at a shift, I think once donors look at a shift, are we just doing it because it's a trend, or are we actually doing it because it's based on statistics?
I like that. And I think we're closing at a really good note with really good questions that hopefully we get a lot of people having these conversations. And I think my last question would always be, continent of Africa, what sustainability measures are we putting in place to stay sustainable with some of the programs that are given to us by donor funding? I don't think it's a resource issue that we're facing right now. It could be just a corruption issue. It could just be a misuse of resource issue, or the lack of accountability and responsibility that comes with running certain programs, that when it was other people doing it for us, donors, we're like, oh, we could do this, we could do this. And donors say, okay, we've set up the tools and things for you to use to continue this program. You'd be surprised how majority of those things fall apart. So, yeah.
That's true. That's actually very true. I think... Yeah?
No, go on.
No, I'm just saying, like, I think I totally agree with you. It's just... There just needs to be, I think, a lot of conversations. And, you know, I think a lot of we see the conversation should be at the top. I think even within our own governments, there should be a lot of discussion, because there are also so many, you know, like government/donor projects that are usually implemented on the ground. And they also come with this really funny requirements. And you look at them, you're like, you are as a government, you are on the ground. You know how it works, and you don't inform the donor. So it's really a lot of questions about this. There should be so many discussions with the right people who have the right interest for, I think, communities at heart, so that, you know, there can actually be like a whole shift in how systems are sort of like placed. Yeah.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. Nuria, I'd like to give you an opportunity to ask me a question.
I think because we are short on time, I just want to ask you, I saw you had so many books on your Instagram account, and I know there's a book we got together to read, so I have two questions. How far are you on our book? And number two, I'm putting you on the spot.
Yeah,
and
you are. Two,
what book are you currently reading now? I mean, I don't even feel bad. I have like so many books, I'm probably like halfway.
I think I stopped on the third chapter.
Okay.
So one thing about me is I lose interest easily. So non-fiction of books and storytelling is really hard for me to read. So that's just my excuse, honestly. And I have been the worst reader for the past 3 months. So I'm doing a lot of audiobooks. So... I'm trying to keep my mind very entertained and everything, but I haven't been the best reader. I'm reading a couple of books. I just finished my friend's book, which is Bloom by Faith Mutanuka. I am reading Yeah, so she released a book a few weeks ago and I just finished reading it. And I'm so glad it's the first book I finished reading during my crisis of not reading. I am also reading So Good, You Can't Get Ignored. I am listening to the TEDx Mentor. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I am also listening to, that's Audible. I am listening to Think and Grow Rich. By Bob Proctor. I'm also listening to Let Them by Mel. The book I always read every day, Hard Day or Not, I know I'm in a crisis, but I always read a book every day, is The Pivot Year by Brianna West. So yeah, I think I have a lot of books in play. I just think I'm in a season that I am somehow not interested in sharing my reading journey. I'm trying to get back to it. I think my Instagram is now getting back to keeping like, oh, I'm reading. I am reading. I'm just, I don't feel like sharing. And I have those moments in the year. It's always this same period. So I'm really glad that I'm coming back to that. So yeah, thanks for putting me on the spot.
No, I think even for me, I remember a few weeks ago I was trying to look for a book club in Nairobi. Because I think growing up, I used to be one of those kids who are really good in compositions and storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so I feel so bad and guilty having abandoned sort of like that other creative aspect of being like a storyteller and reading, you know, fictional books. And you remember, like, I think when we met, when we had the date at the bookshop, I was trying to explore African writers. And
me too, actually.
Yeah, I think that has been so good. I've been getting so many good recommendations from colleagues and friends. And please don't feel like I put you on this, but I think for everyone, I think reading as a journey is really it's usually a bit of a struggle because there's just also so much happening and sometimes you just don't have the time to keep on reading. But yeah, I think you're doing a lot, which is good. You've given me morale to like also maybe do a bit of TED Talks. I used to be into TED Talks and then I sort of like shifted. But I think there's a really nice podcast I'd like to share with you. It's called Talk to Me Direct. Called Talk to Me Direct. And it's about the whole NGO space and, you know, this growing growing urge to seek accountability from governments and youth involvement in, you know, the fight for justice. So I think it's a really good podcast. We could, and I think I listened to you. I think the one you've mentioned is called Think and Grow Rich. I think I've seen that. Yeah,
I know, so, some of my favorites on Audible. I love Bob Proctor's work. So yeah, I have found it. It's Talk to Me Directly, right?
Yeah, Talk to Me Direct. It's really, really good.
Okay, found it. I will listen in. Nuria, you know what, concluding, and I love you so much, but I would like to know, what are you looking forward to?
Oh my God, apart from the farmhouse, I don't know what else I'm looking for.
Yeah, apart from our dream to own a farmhouse, we could be neighbors miles and miles away apart.
But I think, just to be very honest with myself, I think I'm looking forward for happiness. I think because life really changes. Last year, I think I was really looking forward for growth in terms of the organization, also professionally and in my career. And since that has also sort of like started, it's not where I wanted to be, but you know, we move. I think I'm looking for contentment and happiness, and I hope I never lose, the urge to always better myself and grow and develop myself and to be a very patient human being because our president is just testing us. And we just need to like focus.
No, I love that for you, and I'm glad that that's such an easy kind of soft something to look forward to. And I am glad I had you on the podcast. I'm very grateful for you and our friendship. And thank you so much for sharing your time, your knowledge with me and everybody else listening. I'm really grateful that we got to do this.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I think it's been fun. We sort of like reconnected and talked about, I think I've also learned a lot. And yeah, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a long time coming and this has been really good.
Thank you. And for everybody listening, catch you on our next episode. Bye for now.
Bye.